Hello, you're listening to Spoiler.
Build.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
That's right, guys, it's podcast time again. We do a film podcast, in case you're listening anew. And I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. With me is Abigail Bain.
Hello.
And Jamie Thomas.
Hello, sausage.
Hello, sausage as well. We're missing a member. They got exploded in a truck, so we're going to soldier on without them to get the mission done and the podcast finished. But normally that would be Anthony Evans. Hi, Anthony. Sorry you couldn't be here because you were exploded. But hopefully he'll be unexploded next week. So, I'm already alluding to the film because I'm clever. The film this week is Sorcerer. And it's not about a magical wizard or mage or anything like that. It's not supernatural in any way. So throw those misconceptions in the bin and listen to Jamie as he tells you what Sorcerer is about.
Okay. So, Sorcerer is a film from 1977 directed by William Friedkin. It's written by Waylon Green and based on the novel by Georges Arnaud. Stars Roy Scheider, Bruno Kremer, Francisco Rabal, apparently a guy called Amadou.
Just the one name?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Like
Prince.
And the plot summary on IMDb is pretty much, sums it up nice and simply. Four unfortunate men from different parts of the globe agree to risk their lives transporting gallons of nitroglycerin across a dangerous South American jungle. It was William Friedkin's follow-up, like not a sequel, it was just his next film after The Exorcist. It's similar to The French Connection, which he'd done earlier, which was the film that William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist, liked enough that he really wanted Friedkin to direct The Exorcist, because he liked that kind of stark, gritty kind of style that he had as a filmmaker. And he wanted that film to have that rather than be like, you know, typical horror film. And that style is very much in play here. But also, particularly towards the end of this film, it does get a little bit more kind of abstract and strange. And despite the fact that there is no, like Rich said, there's no supernatural anything in this film, it is very creepy towards the end and unsettling.
Yeah. And we should say, listener, that it's Jamie's pick. That's why he's so informed and anxious to get talking. And the reason Jamie picked it, I shall tell you, is because he's obsessed with all things Exorcist. And it's almost like every film he will ever suggest has to some way link back to The Exorcist. So
you are officially worse than me in Highlander.
If ever,
that's hard.
Abby just likes Highlander quite a lot. And little big Clancy Brown. And, you know, she doesn't bang on about it endlessly and reference films that are made. Like, she doesn't find everything based on a tangent that links to it. You, Jimmy, your Exorcist loving ways seem to mean that anyone associated with that film is therefore a good suggestion in any other film. Like, any other film they're connected with can be suggested to us. So,
Well, most of my contribution to this podcast is going to be me talking about The Exorcist, but in my defense, sort of, the part of the reason I picked this was also because of this really strange production history it had. Not production history, actually, like release history and everything that came afterwards. It had a really troubled production, which it's one of those films you can kind of tell because it looks like it was hard to make. Like, everybody in it's always dirty and wet and tired. And it cost, like, it reminds me a lot of Apocalypse Now, which is another one of my favourite films, in the production history and just the film itself. Because it started off with the specific budget and then it, like, ballooned after that and it had loads of issues. But once it was released, I think what happened was two studios ended up owning the rights because I think one of them abandoned it. So it was Universal and Paramount, I think. And then there was this strange kind of battle for who actually had the rights to it. And the version that was released, like home video and then eventually DVD, was a different cut. So it didn't, like, I think one version didn't have the prologues.
Which is kind of impossible if you don't have them, yeah. Really.
And another version had the prologues, but they were moved so that they happened as flashbacks throughout the film.
I mean, I could see that working, but I think they need to go top of the thing. That's what's kind of interesting about it.
Oh yeah, it sets everything up. But William Friedkin has been unhappy with the available versions of it ever since. And if you go on Amazon and search for Sorcerer, it's a shame because Amazon does this like weird thing where they like consolidate all their reviews. So if you look up the new version of Sorcerer, which is the one I assume we all saw, because you guys had all the prologues at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Okay, then I think we all watched the right version, which is William Friedkin's supervised like edit and remaster that came out last year. But because they just shove all their reviews for one thing together, his one-star review for the previous version is in the reviews. And it's brilliant, because if you're scrolling through the reviews and you see this one star and all these like other like five-star reviews, and it's just one star, and it starts with, "This is William Friedkin." And he just goes on this rant about how terrible this version is.
This is not the baby I created. It's been mutilated and ruined.
I love the fact that he's so passionate about it. He went on Amazon and gave his own film one star just to let people know how angry he was. But then, yeah, last year or whenever it was, the rights issue was resolved. There was a lawsuit and everything. And then he got to go back and recut it and go back to the original like film footage and remaster it completely. And now it looks fantastic. Like I rented it on Amazon, even just in standard definition. And it looked great. Like, I'll probably buy the Blu-ray after this, just because I thought it looked fantastic, and I like the film, but I'll get into that. But yeah, so I picked it just because it's been forgotten.
I get it. You're embroiled and fascinated with it on many levels, and that's fair enough.
But it's also a lot of people talk about how it's the one of the last films of the new Hollywood era, which was like the era in the 70s when more kind of like challenging and avant-garde films like this or Apocalypse Now and stuff like that were being made and doing well.
Well, I think what I heard in the reading up on it was what was happening in cinema was stuff like Star Wars came out, and it was like that reshaped the landscape of what was popular in the cinema. And this is the end, in a sense, of gritty 70s challenging cinema.
So this film was kind of the death knell of that, and it led into the like blockbuster type of, you know, event movies. And a lot of people now, because it got panned by critics and it didn't do well at the box office, but a lot of people look back on it now and consider it like one of Friedkin's best films and kind of like a lost classic of the 70s. And I know Friedkin himself this is his favorite film of his that he's made.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of information there that I didn't know coming into watching it. And that's when I just saw the trailer, I was like, well, this looks a bit weird. It sort of had clips of non-jungle stuff happening, people being robbed and stuff. And I was like, and then it suddenly became this weird, I don't know, mercenaries with guns and stuff. And I was like, I'm not really sure what this is about. But I thought it looked kind of interesting.
It is a strange film. Also, I want to say another reason I picked it is it's got Roy Scheider in it.
Good call. Good in Jaws. He took that shark down.
Good in everything. Just a good, craggy, worn-out, leathery face.
And that's not the shark, that's Roy Scheider.
Yeah.
I'm Scheider. So not used to seeing Roy Scheider look clean and unsweaty. That at the beginning of this movie, when he was the gangster and he was, you know, quite well turned out, I thought he had a fake nose.
He's not really. He's an unusual straight down kind of bridge on his nose. But yeah, he doesn't look right until he's a bit sweaty and dirty.
Yeah. He's just, I don't know, he's one of those. He he's one of those actors who's like, he's the definition of like grit. He's very earthy. He's one of my favorite actors.
Hmm. Good choice.
So, Abby, what were you expecting from Sorcerer?
Well, the word sorcerer carries a certain amount of baggage with it, none of which apply.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it should be called Deliverance, but in a truck. Like,
just call it lorry.
Lorries. Yeah.
Lorries. Lorries.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
I mean, Sorcerer isn't even the name of the truck that makes it.
Yeah, I know. I like that. I have always assumed, whenever I've heard about it, because I've never actually read up on it, I always assumed that there was some supernatural element to it. And I think a lot of people do.
It's a interesting choice for a name of... It doesn't tell you from the get-go what it's going to be, and it kind of misleads you. But, you know, if you see the trailer, you know, well, it's not about magic, and unless it's secretly, you know, got that at the end or something.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you think it's going to be about people uncovering a tomb and unleashing magic or something, but you get a sense from the trailer, which I think we'd all seen, that it's going to be a kind of, some kind of jungle-based action-y disaster thing. But I even from the poster, I thought the poster, which was like of one of the trucks on a rickety bridge in terrible weather conditions, thought that was a school bus, and I was waiting for the school buses to turn up until I fathomed it was, oh, the start bit was just like little vignettes, and this is mainly about trucks in the jungle, so yeah. I don't know. But Abby, you were expecting from the trailer what? Like,
well, I was expecting some kind of magical element.
Just maybe there somewhere.
And it did hint to it every now and again, where the sorcerer truck had a similar sort of face to this
Aztec rock.
Yeah, that cropped up a couple of times, I think. But then they didn't really. Nothing came of it.
A lot of it is deliberate, according to Friedkin. Like, he created imagery that like suggested or evoked. Like monstrous, supernatural, or like gods and that kind of stuff. Because one of the ideas he had when he put the film together was this idea of like fate and how it messes with people.
Mm.
Like the idea of fate and how it can just like fork in different directions unexpectedly. And that's where the sorcerer title comes from. I can't remember the full explanation.
As if there's some kind of evil, malevolent sorcerer controlling people's lives and sending them down a road into hell. At times, it kind of feels a bit like, once it gets going and you know where it's about, it feels like it's several criminals in purgatory being punished and dealing with like a descent and torturing, being tortured essentially to, you know, fulfill their time in purgatory, you know, like it's a descent into hell, it's purgatory, and maybe it's this fate malevolence thing. I don't know.
It's described as an existential thriller.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, can be, without thinking about the title and what the themes are, it's a fairly straightforward thriller as well. It's, you know, it doesn't have to be thought about in what is he trying to say about people's lives, fate, punishment. Because all of the people who go on this journey are anti-heroes to some extent because they're criminals who are fleeing from their crimes. And we should, you know, get into the minutiae of the film and talk about what happens in it a bit more, I think. So, essentially, the opener is... four very different vignettes in different locations. Abby, do you want to explain some of the vignettes to see how you find articulating them?
Well, the first vignette was set in Veracruz, Mexico. And it was about Nilo, who is an assassin. I'll bring it up now, since I'm directly talking about him. But he's the one who I didn't understand... why he was in Porvenir later. Because he bought his way in, and it seemed like he had a purpose, and then didn't.
We'll come back to that, because it'll be relevant as we talk about him, because we haven't discussed, you know, this jungly South American place yet. But yeah, he is just a simple story of an assassin killing someone.
Then we go to Jerusalem, Israel, and a couple of terrorists cause an explosion, and one of them escapes. His name is Kasim, I think.
Yeah, Kasim. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but yeah.
Then we move on to Paris, France, where we have Victor, who is in banking in some way, has done something very, very bad.
Yeah, he's been accused of fraud, and he's got like 24 hours to appeal or offer some kind of explanation or proof. So him and his business partner are trying to find some way out. And then when his partner kills himself instead of helping him, he decides, well, I best be off.
I really love the way where he thought about it for a minute and then just pegged it down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. The thought process is, what am I going to do now? But he just runs off.
I'll just tell a waiter in a restaurant to tell my wife I'm off. And yeah. Off I go, running down the street, as Abby says.
Did he go the furthest distance?
I mean, you want to get your glow up and your measuring stick out. What do you want to do?
Well, he actually ran all the way.
That's what made me think of it, because we just see him running down the road, and then...
And then he's South America.
Yeah.
Well, Israel isn't that close either to South America. Actually, okay, so we've got one more to go. You should describe it, Abby.
Some mobsters in New Jersey. Rob a church?
Possibly a crime-affiliated corrupt church that has money from bingo or something.
It's run by Richie or Reese, mob boss. I like the way that they show that. Like, at first, it's just presented as a church and there's a wedding happening, and then these scumbags come in and like. But there's something dodgy going on with the church because they're dividing the money up and talking about different, different crooked businesses that it's going to be going to, or different like activities that they're going to be using it for. Mm. And then there's a shot of the wedding as Roy Scheider and his gang of thieves, his merry men.
what I liked about the wedding is they cut to the bride and groom, and the bride has like a black eye, and there's this sense of this isn't a great wedding either, so don't worry about it.
Something's up here.
Yeah.
So that was. By like, oh, okay, this is a because one of the priests counting the money also says, do you know who owns this church? And then I saw the black eye and I thought, okay, this, but yeah, as they're driving off, they get into an argument because one of them just callously just shoots a priest, and then Reichheit is distracted while he's driving, and they hit a truck, and it's one of the most spectacular car crashes. I have ever seen it. Everyone goes everywhere. Like, the car flips, people fly out of the windows, and it apparently freaking destroyed a ton of cars just to get that shot right. Well, one of the things about William Friedkin that I've learned in my love of The Exorcist and reading up about him is that he's possibly psychotic. Because he's fucking mental. There's so much insane stuff, and people either like love working with him because he's exhilarating, or they hate it because they think this guy should be in an institution.
He wants carnage and scary stuff to look scary and carnage-y.
If he could get away with killing someone on film to get that shock and realism, he probably maybe would.
I'd like to think he'd draw the line at doing it because he knows it would take more than one take, and he'd probably have to offer through people, and he'd be like, it's not ethical enough. I could kill one guy if I knew the take would be good, but I can't trust my cameraman to get it.
Yeah, but the results are on the screen.
Yes, blood, money, and Irish-American gangsters everywhere.
Yeah. But that was a hell of a car crash.
It was, and what I liked was it was partly caused by celebrating / arguing Irish-American guys sort of singing horrible rubbish songs and arguing, and it was just, you died because you're kind of irritating as people and distracting.
you've just, you know, mob church it may be, you have just robbed a church and shot a priest.
Yeah.
And now you're just acting like a bunch of dicks in a car as well. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But Rob Schneider. Oh dear.
Oh.
What's the name of the character?
Jackie.
So Jackie is the sole survivor of the accident, and has to go on the lam. Along with they're all going on the lam. So
yeah, they all run off, and he sets up a guy says, I meet this guy, get on this plane, and then I guess this guy this guy he meets that I don't think we ever see.
Yeah.
Just does this for people who need to escape. He forges them passports and sends them to this shanty town in South America.
Yeah. I think, what was the place called, Abby?
Povina.
I think, looking it up, it was in Chile. It doesn't really care that much if you know. I think it's just, so some, poor shanty town in South America somewhere that has lots of jungle and people who are sad and a little bit worn out everywhere. Yeah.
That car crash as well, and a couple of the scenes before it, is when I started to wonder or be surprised that the film is still rated PG.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I know. That was my reaction as well, because this is a violent film.
I guess. Yeah, but they're quite obviously covered in paint.
Yeah, that's true.
It is very stagey, cinematic 70s blood.
Sure. And also, I guess a lot of it is, well, a lot of people are just suffering. There's a lot of people who are struggling and going through harsh times. But there's no, there's no outright, obvious, gun in hand violence. I mean, actually, there is a lot of gun shooting, but, it's odd that it's PG. I would have suspected it would be higher.
Later on, when the oil rig explodes.
Yeah, I mean, we have an assassin. Like, this is the thing. These are the stories, Mexican assassin, a Middle Eastern terrorist of some kind. We don't really know. They dress up as Jewish guys and bomb a place.
Yeah,
it's some kind of terrorist attack.
He is anti-Semitic because he befriends an old German guy who appears to probably be some kind of ex-Nazi.
Yeah.
And when Nilo kills that guy, Kasim goes nuts and starts calling him a Zionist.
Right.
So there's obviously
issues.
He's got that's the thing.
Yeah.
None of them, even Roy Scheider, none of them are particularly pleasant characters in any way.
Yeah. So,
they're kind of likable, but none of them are really decent or good guys or anything.
Yeah, we're in on their journey and we sympathise with them a bit because, we'd all appreciate, we all would feel, if we had got stuck in their situation, we'd all, feel terrible. And we go on the journey with them, so we empathise with them a little bit, even if they are bad guys. So, assassin, terrorist, thief, and then who have I missed out? Oh, the French guy's a fraudster. So we've got a fraudster, a thief, an assassin, and a terrorist. And it seems like it's setting up to be a bad joke. And I guess for them it was. But they all end up in this odd South American shanty town, and this is the thing I don't really understand. Is, I mean, I get random people from places end up in one place, but why are they being sent here exactly? I know there's not many police and it's not easy to be tracked down, but
I think it's
weird.
It's the closest thing to nowhere without being in the middle of Siberia and just dying.
Yeah.
It's still civilization, but it's an easy way for someone who wants to disappear to just, to do exactly that, I suppose.
Yeah. And, its main form of commerce is American oil drill. Like, they're drilling for oil out in the jungle somewhere, and it's a town associated with that, and that's the economy of this just horrible, corrupt shanty town full of horrible cops, corrupt officials, and... Yeah, it's just, it essentially spends a little bit of time establishing that all these guys who found themselves there are in a worse place than prison. They have almost less freedoms.
Much.
They're kind of, they can do what they want, but they have to pay money to the police, and they live in poverty, and they all want to escape there almost instantly. So it's kind of a fate worse than prison, and a little bit better than death.
It's now I think about it, actually, it's interesting that you brought up like the purgatory thing, because that seems to be what that place is.
It's almost one of the reasons perhaps they didn't make a big deal of where it is. They didn't want to say Chile is hell on earth. You know, they wanted to say this situation is like purgatory, where you will be punished for your sins until it's fair. Or whatever.
The film does a really good job of like creating that atmosphere of just, it feels hopeless and bleak.
And there's dirt on dirt, on rust, on women, on dogs.
Yeah.
Like, it's just really, like, you know, it's just a depressing, sad, worn-out place. With dirty, dingy bars and just, you know, metal corrugated iron forming houses out of grot. You know, it's just really bleak. Abby, what did you make of this lovely tourist vacation they all went on?
It was just essence of dirty.
Yeah, I felt watching it.
And it is there to say, you guys have landed yourselves in a terrible predicament that's got you here, and they're all kind of searching for a way to, you know, leave, because they feel like this was too an extreme an escape or whatever.
They did do a really good job of making it totally understandable that these men would choose to do a really dangerous job.
Yeah.
For money.
And that is the main premise of the film, is that the situation is, it comes about, you know, there's an explosion at the oil rig thing out in the jungle. There's a massive fire that can't be put out by conventional means, a.k.a. water. And so the opportunity emerges that a, like, it's such a crazy situation. Essentially, through cheapness and incompetence, some nitroglycerin is required to blow up the site so it stops being on fire. But also, that nitroglycerin has not been contained properly and neglected, and so it's dangerous. And it's a very volatile explosive, needs transporting, and they can't do it by helicopter. They have to do it via trucks. And essentially, the people who are sort of in charge of the running of the ground, the running of the business, are saying, we will pay a large, it's an incredibly dangerous job, but the pay is good, but terrible if you think about what they actually have to do.
Yeah. You might die. There's a very good chance you'll die, but if you make it, you get $20,000. And I think it's the, they will like help, like
give them a valid passport
get them out of where they are.
So it's any local, because it's open to lots. It's open to anyone who can claim to be a truck driver, and so they have kind of tryouts. And essentially, three out of our four main characters get the job as going on these two trucks that they have to kind of do a montage to build the trucks once they're hired. It's kind of funny. These rusty rubbish trucks are put together, like Lego by these guys. but three of our main guys get the job, and the fourth guy, as Abby has already mentioned, has to assassinate the fourth man, we haven't had a vignette for, so he's not important to us.
Yeah.
Presumably, it would have been of his Nazi crimes in World War II if he'd have had a vignette. I feel kind of bad. He gets killed and replaced by the assassin. He just decides to kill him and roll with it. You know?
My assumption about Nilo, or Nilo, was that, because he's an assassin, so people hire him to take out other people.
Hmm.
I assumed that in some way he was involved with what happens to Jackie. Not with what happens to him, but...
Yeah. Might have been sent by...
By Reese.
Yeah.
And that's why what happens at the end happens.
Maybe. Abby, you had some problems with this character, so is this part, is this getting to the core of what you didn't understand?
The thing about, I'm going to go with Nilo, was just, all the other ones, you understood why they were there, because they were on the run, and being on the run means you end up in places like that. But with him, because his job involves travel, you assume he's there to kill someone.
He could have had a better manner, safe house as well, couldn't he, than this place?
Yeah. It's like, really? You, this is where you're hiding out?
So I think about it, I think, I think he's there for the same reason the rest of them are, and I think his demeanour is just his way of coping with it.
He seems more in the know and confident, but we know the least about him. He kills one guy, and he's there. He turns up on the plane like all of them did, and he is more collected and confident because perhaps he's more on board with killing people suddenly. But maybe he's there maybe as a red herring to make us think, oh, is he like, because we know he's an assassin, maybe he's there to infiltrate the group and to sabotage and then it's just, or do something, you know.
No, he's just another one like the rest of these guys. Yeah. Like, he's just here and he just acts as if he's like, no, I'm totally cool with this. I'm fine. And then, because he goes on that journey with them, and he kind of breaks down as it goes on. Like, he falls, like, his whole, like, by the time he gets to, like, the end of his part of the story with Roy Scheider in the truck, he looks like a different person.
He's lost his fedora. He's still got his pencil moustache, but he's looking spectacularly rough. Yeah. They all do.
I think it could be that he turns up there, and you're supposed to think at first, oh, hang on. He's been sent to kill them, and then I think the slow reveal, and it never, because one of the things this film doesn't do, which I like, is that it doesn't really spell anything out. It gives you the situations, and you can draw your own conclusions. And I think, especially now that I really think about it, I think he turns up as a red herring to make you think that something's going on, and then it just turns out that he's just stuck there like everyone else. Although him killing that ex-Nazi, that he could have been sent there to do that.
Yeah, I took it to mean in his desperation, he tried for the job as well. So in his desperation, he kills him at a crucial moment so that, well, you can cancel the mission and arrest me. Yeah, exactly. And basically, you know, he's took on because let's just do this. We all want the money and we all want to get this done. Let's not quibble. We don't care about the Nazi guy enough. he was part of the montage, putting all the rusty trucks together, painting the word sorcerer on one of the things. He was one of the guys building them trucks, and now he's dead. But, I missed it, totally. I didn't get why it was called sorcerer. I missed that one of the trucks was called sorcerer.
One was Lazaro or something?
Yeah.
Abby had to tell me afterwards that, like, Well, Abby had spotted it, but like you were saying, Abby, it isn't even the significant truck that makes it the furthest.
Yeah,
it's the other truck that isn't. You know, it's not even a big focus of the film.
Yeah, that was actually my favorite thing about it, because obviously, if the film is called that and the truck is called that, that's the one that's going to survive. That's the truck. Yeah. That's the main character.
Mm. So surely the film should be called Lazaro or something.
Apparently it was. It was going to be called Lazarus, and that's where that name is from. Who's the one who rose from the dead or lived forever or something.
I would just like to bring to your attention, think about what the sorcerer truck looked like, haggard. Now imagine what that looked like new.
Just can't. It was kind of makeshift.
Yeah.
It could have been this evil truck that wanted to get people killed. Maybe it was a sorcerer trapped in the engine of a truck.
Yeah. I liked one of the things I liked about it once they get going is that the trucks become these kind of monsters. They become these lumbering beasts.
Yeah.
Mm. And all the like shots of them coming at the camera or from underneath them. Mm. I think it's the IMDb trivia that a lot of the sound effects, because it got nominated for Best Sound. It was the only Academy Award it was nominated for. Because there's a lot of, I think it's Sorcerer. Its engine noises are underlaid with noises of a lion.
Ooh.
And then Lazaro, I think, has the sounds of a cougar mixed in with the engine sounds.
Oh, very clever.
So he was like deliberately trying to get them to sound like animals.
And generally, with regard to the sound, the music it's used is very John Carpenter-like. It's kind of a mysterious, dread-filled noise, and then at times a bit supernatural. It's very effective, though. I like it.
I think the first film scored by the band Tangerine Dream.
Really?
And it's what like, one of the things that helped them in their career, because they did the score for Legend as well.
Oh.
And a few other films, I can't remember. But, they were a synth band.
It's very good. It put me in mind of John Carpenter, but obviously
it
was that era, so it's just something that's a bit of a sound of the time.
It's risky when a 70s film has synth soundtrack, because sometimes...
Well, it wasn't poppy in 80s.
Yeah, because sometimes a synth soundtrack is absolutely hideous.
Yeah, I think this is something of an advantage, because it was synth before synth was popular.
Yeah, and it's also, they're very good at just being atmospheric with it, rather than just like, bow, bow, bow.
Yeah.
But like, it's not just,
it's
not somebody with a Casio just going, DJ, DJ.
Yeah.
Sure. Dictionary.
So, you know, effective sound all round. We agree with their little nom that they got. But yeah, essentially, we got two trucks, three boxes of dynamite in some kind of sand to keep them steady. That's highly volatile because, I don't know, nitroglycerin, when it isn't faffed with, is dangerous and leaky.
Yeah, you have to... Because they say you when it's stored, they need to turn the boxes every now and again. Otherwise, the nitroglycerin seeps to the bottom.
Right.
So then it's all concentrated at the bottom. So, like, if they knocked it or nudged it, it would all just go up. Mm. One of the things I liked, which comes back to the fact that this film doesn't spell anything out, they never show them loading the explosives onto the trucks. There's just a shot of them buried in the sand, and then that's it.
But they do establish, you know, the guy who is just checking the nitroglycerin, the guy who's going to be in charge of detonating the site where the fire is, and he's checking them, and he's their expert. He tells the boss or whatever, or the guy in charge, about it, and what he explains what you just said, and they don't show it at the site, skipping along, spoiling the film before we've even talked about it, but getting to the site where it's delivered, we don't even have them detonating the site, which I think was a bold move, because we have a tower of fire going off constantly. We didn't need to see another controlled explosion or whatever.
Yeah, that's another nice, like, almost religious... image that the film plays on a lot,
like at the gates of hell,
that like column of fire that's just there the whole time this story's going on, and then the final approach when Roy Scheider makes it at the end with his one crate, and it's just jet in front of him.
I thought they were a bit rough with Roy Scheider at the end. It's like he's carrying a dodgy box of dynamite nitroglycerin. Yes, nudgy.
He's walking towards a column of flames, and he's walked who knows how far. I mean, 2 miles, I think he's gone or something, and he's out of it. So they want the box off of the man and safe, and they let him wander towards it a bit longer before he passes out. It's fantastic visual.
Mm.
And cutting away and not showing the point of the journey was I thought, bold. And they just cut back to, back
it
in
was
the town.
Bold, and I did like it. But on the other hand, I did sort of want to know how that works exactly. Like, how exactly are you going to extinguish a fire with an explosion?
Just throw it.
Yeah. Fight fire with fire. That's, you know, haven't you ever heard the old say? next time your house is on fire, because I know it's happened several times, get yourself a flamethrower and put that bastard out.
So anyway, back to where we were. They, two trucks, three boxes in each of nitroglycerin, two people in each truck. The French guy, the fraudster, is with the Middle Eastern terrorist. They're like a duo. Mm. And the assassin, who's blagged his way onto the trip, even though he wasn't supposed to be, is with Roy Scheider, who is a thief. And they pair up, and they have to stay about, 15 minutes apart in case, you know, one explodes, the other one will explode. And they're on this rickety hill journey. And that is the bulk of our film, is two trucks, four guys, and a shit ton of explosives. Let's travel through the worst road imaginable, through the jungle. Like, they compete with a lot of things, and I'm sure we'll talk about a few of them in more detail, but it's a big old ask.
One of my least expected hurdles of this journey was just some local guy in a loincloth titting about.
That's true. That was.
I love that. That was the first challenge that they came up against. this guy just going in front of his truck for ages. There's two of them.
There's like a little family, isn't there, of people? Yeah. And like the dad or whatever of the group decides of this little tribey loincloth wearing guys is just as you say, just what's he? He's a bit of a card. And he hops in front of the truck and he's dancing about going, hey, it's a truck, I'm in your way. And it's like, dude, we're all going to blow up because you thought you were a bit funny.
Also, if you were hungry for a lift, this is not how you go about it.
Yeah.
Well, I
stick your thumb out.
Yeah, there's easier ways. But, you know, hopefully he amused the people he set out to amuse. He seemed happy enough. But the first peril dealt with. Man messing about in a loincloth. we have like a rickety corner with loads of logs that are going to give way. Oh no! But of course, they get over all this. This is the easy stuff. They're scared, but this is the beginning. Rickety corners, dirty roads, bumpety bumps. You know.
I really like the way that Kazim, when his wheel's stuck in that first rickety corner bridge, and the guy's like, "Come forward." He's just like, "No. No, I'm not doing that."
Yeah.
But all it took was, come on. All right. All right.
Yeah.
Well, she got to go. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a bit like one of those shows where, like, the world's dangerous roads, where I wouldn't have mind if, like, Ed Byrne and Rod Gilbert or just a couple of British celebrities were put together to chat on the road. You know, this could have been a comedy, quite frankly, if they'd just had some comedians doing the road travelling.
Oh, comedy remake of Sorcerer.
Yeah.
With Rob Schneider.
Dylan Moran. Who else could we have? No, let's not cast the comedy. It'll be too sad that it won't get made.
Yeah, I'm too scared that it might actually be picked up.
on a side note, because I had parallels to Deliverance, that was one of the films that I thought it was a bit like. Only, you know, it wasn't a holiday gone wrong, it was a... I guess it was a holiday gone wrong of sorts. But these guys are in trucks rather than canoes. And there's no, thankfully, there's no pig-obsessed rapists in the forest. There are mercenaries, but they're much more sensible. They don't want to do weird stuff. They just want to rob them. But that's later. And because Deliverance has a bit of a weird title as well, I did kind of think, well, maybe this could be called, if not Deliverance, then maybe Deliver This. That could have been a title. Deliver This. And then just... It's a bit more obvious. That was just a thought. You know, just putting it out there. Deliverance, this is the sequel, Deliver This, that's all.
Deliver This with two exclamation marks afterwards.
And one upside down at the front. Like Southern American style. So, what else? Perils, Abby. Do you remember some other perils you found either exciting or funny?
Well, I think they went over the same rope bridge as each other.
Oh, yeah.
But one after the other, a little apart. Mm. And that I would have given up then, before even trying to go onto that bridge. We were like, nope.
What I liked as well is, before the rope bridge, which seems ridiculous for a truck to go over a rope bridge anyway, was, there was some debate over which was the correct way. Should we follow the map, which might go through a slightly boggy area, or go take the high road? And the French guy was like, dude, we are going the way the map says. I don't care. And the map says to go over this rickety bridge, and it's just like, we definitely should have took the other path. maybe we could go back. But you're right, they shouldn't have attempted that. I mean, it wasn't even a complete rope bridge. It was a prop, it was a big one, but it was like full of holes and broken bits of wood, and it didn't even look drivable.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know what, I think it was Roy Scheider that went onto the bridge and was sort of kicking it and stuff, trying to decide if it would take it. It's like, the weight of a man is not eligible to find out if a lorry will go over this bridge.
Yeah, this is,
Well, the assassin
guy...
Go on.
I was just going to say, every time that they're confronted with an obstacle on their journey, I like that their response ultimately is, "Oh, all right."
I don't think he does it in this bit, but he does it quite soon after that when they come across a fallen tree. But I like the various interludes through this movie where Roy Scheider just has a little strop on. And so he's got a machete and he's having some trees at one point. Yeah. And then there's another bit where he's just having a little bang of the ground in the mud.
The best bit about the bit where he chops the trees is no one will do it. And he says, it's like, oh, we'll cut them down. Like, it's the only thing we can do. And he starts doing it. He like angrily takes like two swipes at the tree with the machete, then looks back really sternly, and then does another two hacks, then looks back. Like, he does two hacks, and he goes, see? And then goes for it again.
What's the funniest thing about it is when he's properly pitching a fit and kind of, he's in the bog, swinging wildly at all these vines, they're not even breaking. The vines aren't breaking, let alone the tree branches. Like, and he's looking back at the smaller ones and they're not even being chopped. It's like the most blunt machete, and he has such a childish like fight with all of these like branches and stuff.
Extra fantastic when he's in a bog and he still manages to fall over the root of a tree.
Yeah. So he's properly exasperated and funny doing so. Yeah.
That bridge sequence was. Because you know how delicate the explosives are, and they do a good job of setting it up. The scenes where one of the trucks is somewhere precarious, like that initial like weird corner bridge thing, they get really intense really quickly.
Yeah,
and so suddenly you're going, oh my god, this is going to blow up, and this is right at the like beginning of their trip. They're obviously not going to explode at this point.
But when you get a massive close-up of mega wheels and logs snapping away and edges, like the truck, you know, it's pretty safe on the edge because there's so much weight. But when you see a wheel basically come off the edge of a cliff and carry on, you go, okay, that just gutturally wrong to see that happen.
That whole sequence where they both go over that shabby-looking bridge was... The first one with Roy Scheider and Nilo is really intense and it almost makes you feel sick.
Yeah.
And then the second one is 100 times worse.
Because, what I liked is to even cross the bridge, like the thief had to give the assassin a row and go, you got on this trip, matey. You're not running away into the jungle. He waggles his finger at him and says, you get out on that bridge and you help me because you killed the nice man who used to be a Nazi. And you are doing it, mister. And he does do it. He really is out on the bridge. He crawls out so far and then he sort of sits down and gestures to keep coming. And then he has to get up and move slightly and sit down again and go, forward, over the bridge,
What I love about the second one is that moment when they're just suddenly sort of accosted by a tree.
Yeah.
Is that you don't see that coming at all. Yeah. And they don't even telegraph it. Like, the actors don't look, even though they know it's going to happen. Yeah. They just take it into the back of them.
Well, first, we forgot to mention, it is lashing it down diagonally with rain.
Yeah.
Like, tropical thunderstorm rain. And there's a point where they're so wet that, like, every layer of them's wet. I think the assassin guy's faffing with his coat. And you're like, what's the point? You got one arm in the sleeve. Everything's wet. Don't put the coat on. It's properly raining.
Having driven through a full-on... Having driven through a full-on rainstorm in Missouri now, I could totally understand how frightening driving across that bridge in that kind of rain would be. Because when it's raining like that, it's so intense, it's white out. You can't see anything. So to be driving a truck full of explosives over a river on a bridge in that kind of rain.
And just the tilt, like part of the poster art is the tilting truck on this bridge. And it's like, just tilting in a truck is bad enough. But in that storm with explosives on a rickety bridge, and the tilt just makes you feel sick. Like, I feel like we're all going to die if you could so easily explode and drown at the same time.
One thing after another. And then the fact that the two guys after them their journey's so much worse. Because, yeah, there's the tree. That first of all, Cassim falls through the bridge.
Yeah.
And I...
And almost gets run over.
Yeah. And it was getting intense enough at this point and far enough in the film that I started thinking...
Well, that's the first death.
Yeah.
I was going to say that just now, actually. A little bit further back, I was going to say, one of the things that really works for this movie is because they haven't just gone, one man drives a truck that's dangerous. Because they've gone with two separate trucks and four different men.
Yeah.
You don't know which one's going to make through it.
And I think they especially set up... is it Serrano, the French guy?
Mm.
Serrano and Jackie as, like, the main characters. Like, they give Cassim and the assassin smaller opening vignettes. Mm. And then they give Jackie and Serrano the bigger ones. So even though, like, you do kind of assume that that someone's going to die, but in the end, probably those two are going to be the last ones left. And even if they, like, kill each other, oh, like, you know only one of them is going to survive. But my assumption was once, the two of them...
Sorry, once you establish, okay, this is a disaster movie, we all kind of know, okay, well, there will be deaths. Mm. Probably the guys we like. But generally speaking, we know they're going to come, we just don't know when. And it kind of messes with what you expect a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't die when you think he's going to do... when you think he's going to. And they kind of die when you weren't even... You know, thinking about it.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to get to. Like, their bridge sequence is horrible. He falls through. He just about makes it up, and then just as he's climbing up onto the front of the truck, that tree comes out of nowhere.
Yeah,
and yeah, like you said, there's no indication that it's coming. Like, he's just survived, and then oh my god, what's this? Like,
we're just covered in sticks now, and I can't move. I'm pinned,
and it's almost. The tree is almost monstrous. Like, it's almost like it's there with intent. Like, it's pushing them off the bridge.
Like, it's some kind of Kraken.
Yeah.
So, and also, they're trying to, like, tow the truck out. Like, they've attached a winch to a tree stump, which is breaking. They're cutting to about three different things. It's a tree stump, the branches that's on the French guy, the rickety bridge itself, the bombs are in the back. Like, it's like, there's so many things to cut to. You don't know which one's going to
be. There's so much at stake.
And then just as the bridge collapses as they're getting to the edge, they just cut away to the other guys going, ha, they're going to die. We're going to get more money. So, those idiots, they'll never get across that. We're awesome. You know.
Just to remind you that they are scumbags in the end. Yeah, and I also like, they go through all that and then there's a tree in the way.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Genius. I mean, it's a genius problem to deal with.
You don't get a sense of how big that tree is until he's standing next to it either. From a distance, you're a bit like, oh, it's just a tree, you can manage that. Oh, wait, no, it's not.
This is a 1,000-year-old tree, like, massive and definitely in the way, despite what the thief thinks he could do about it with his machete.
I didn't know what Cassim was up to for the longest time when he was setting up that elaborate MacGyver invention.
Quite shortly in, I was like, oh, well, guys, you got trucks full of dynamite. Tree, dynamite, bam, surely. Yeah. And then it took me a while to get there, but then the terrorist guy, he was like looking at the tree, sizing it up, going, guys, it's okay, I got this. And then they all sort of help him find rocks. I love the bonding they did as they fished for rocks, and they offered him different types, and like the assassin would be like, this rock, he'd be, no, and then he'd put it aside, and then the next guy, like the French guy, would be like, this rock, yeah, that's an okay rock, let's have that. Yeah, that's a good rock, you know, it's this little team of them fishing for rocks.
Set to that song that, I don't know the name of it, you know, look around your world, pretty baby, is it everything you thought it'd be, as he, like, turns down different rocks. And but, I love that he comes up with this, like, Boy Scout, like, setup for blowing up the tree. And the tree explosion, that's another thing I wanted to say. Every explosion that happens in this film is spectacular.
And loud. Explosions are loud.
Big,
Abby,
before we go over that bit, I really like that he made the guy show his pockets, and I thought he just wanted to know what was in his pockets, and then he took his pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a nice moment as well, because we're all a bit distrusting of the assassin guy. And he's got the flick knife out. And we all kind of knew, well, he's not going to stab him. They're setting up like he is. He's obviously going to do something or suspect yeah. something. And then he just takes the pocket off and is like, we put sand in this and we've got this weird elaborate setup where basically a big rock will be the base and a rock is tied to a rope and some sticks. And we will run away, back up the trucks, hide, and then sand will leak from a bag till it drops a rock on the nitroglycerin that's leaking out. And boom, 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 up goes the tree, and we'll all come back and see if we've done all right, you know. And this was a good scene.
This was actually the first time as well I thought, hang on, because don't presumably, how much of the explosives do the guys at the burning oil plant need?
It did occur to me. They've used one from one.
Because then I thought, yeah, truck. You...
If you they're can't... the ones that make it, they've only got two.
Yeah. But then I, like, that's, I think, when it becomes, it doesn't matter now. Like, they just have to get there.
Yeah.
And explain it when they arrive.
Hmm. Plus, like, there's yeah, a little
you
bit
guys,
of...
You're missing a third of one of these boxes. What's going on here? You yeah. don't know.
What it took.
I've just been through. Just... pick up some dirt and fill in the rest of it.
It would have been good, actually, if they'd have got there and they'd put the fire out anyway. Or just burnt
yeah.
the oil run out and it stopped burning.
Yeah.
I thought that...
so long to get here, it just put itself out.
I thought with that massive rainstorm that they would have got there and the whole place would have been washed out.
Thing is, it's the when you... I think when like an oil fissure ignites, it's fueling itself. Because the oil is just spewing up from the ground, and whatever's not on fire, as soon as it comes out, hits the fire that's already there, and it just keeps igniting.
Mm.
But it doesn't matter if like it rains, because it's still pumping up from the ground. Mm. I don't know exactly how it works. That was my assumption.
It's fine. I think it's common knowledge that fire plus oil is bad. Like,
yeah.
The old, what is it? The little triangle of energy plus fire plus... No, fuel plus... Oh, I'm not going to bring up my GCSE sides right now. So, anyway, tree trunk exploded. Everyone just sort of stares and goes, yeah.
That's good.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, they quietly... They're pleased, but they're also quietly... Please, they're not. They don't make yeah. a. Yeah, they're not like celebrating because they know they still got to keep going.
Yeah, does that means now they can't give up?
Now
they
we drive the trucks of explosives some more in the yeah. forest or jungle or whatever. Yeah. What else do we have? We've got the two trucks over the rickety bridge is iconic. The tree trunk is very standout. How do we? Then essentially it becomes that this is when we say, okay, we haven't forgot we're a disaster movie and disaster movies yeah. equal deaths, and they're just driving along a fairly easy bit of path, and the French yeah. guy is having a little chat with the terrorist guy and discussing his wife and Paris and the watch he's got that celebrates like their 10 years together with his wife, and it's lovely little chat, insight to the characters. And then it's like, pop goes a tyre, off the edge of a, off down the hill a bit, uh-oh, we're tipping forward, bang, we've exploded, and two of them are now dead.
the bridge scene, because I got three scenes in this that were like my favourite. Hmm. There was the bridge scene, there was one a little bit later on, and then there was this, because it's so callous and it's so out of nowhere that two of, especially after everything they've been through and everything they survived, like yeah. getting over that bridge, and then what kills them is the sheer bad luck of the tire blowing out.
Yeah,
there's no reason for it at all. Nobody makes a mistake. Well, nobody messes up. It just
yeah. I guess they're not really like once they're chatting and feeling a bit not bleak, just sad and. Intent, like before all their trials and tribulations, they were still driving a truck that could explode, so they were kind of concentrating and scared. But now they've become slightly complacent enough to have optimism and chat. And then, as soon as you're like happy, even a tiny fraction, fate apparently hates you and you're going to die.
as Dylan Moran said, and then the cage comes down. But it was just, it was amazing. And especially, like I was saying, Serrano is presented almost as one of two main characters. Mm. And then the film just goes, actually, do you know what? And it, like, shakes the Etch-a-Sketch and just wipes him out, him and Kasim. And there's not even a, you don't even get to see them react. The tire pops, the truck goes off the cliff, that's it, gone.
Yeah. And there goes Sorcerer. The name of the film has gone and exploded.
And that's the other great thing about it as well. It's not just it's two of the main characters with no build up. It's the main character, the truck called Sorcerer.
Yeah, but
and it's half their payload as well. Hmm. So do they go on? Like what happens?
And double the payout for the remaining two, though, right? That's a thumbs up.
Yeah, I like their reaction when they just look at the explosion from a distance and they're like,
yeah, because they had to stop to tinker with their engine, didn't they?
Yeah,
that's the weird thing. It's because they have to keep a distance. They're always, you know, apart when they need to be. And it just means they have to go. They're like, well, we know they exploded and, oh, gosh, that's what could happen to us. And we have to investigate. We have to go that way and investigate or at least look.
Yeah.
And, they trundle along and they get to the site and they're just only just discovering that, you know, that what obviously happened. And then let's amp up the danger again. Here's a weird mercenary-looking group of bandits who are going to rob you of whatever you've got.
Seemingly, they go, like, "Oh,
just
you guys. That is some timing." Let me tell you about the day I've had.
Yeah. Well, but if you want to rob some toilet paper from us, that's fine. Yeah. It's just toilet paper. You don't want none of that.
I would have been honest, I think, if they'd gone, what have you got? I've got some dynamite that's gone off, but I've got to take it anyway. Take it if you want. You will blow up.
Yeah. To be honest, I'd rather you had the truck.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even usable dynamite. You won't get it anywhere. It's intense because we got a couple of guys holding the truck up with guns and a guy going around the back to deal with the what's in the truck. And so it splits the team up. But also the assassin, who we have established, is a cold-hearted killer. We know he's going to be stubborn, and he is stubborn, and he's partly injured. And he's possibly even dying. He seems to have a bit of a cough.
Yeah, I actually thought he was about to maybe have a heart attack or something. Like, he was not right. Well.
Can't be
and again, this is the point of the film as well, where he doesn't even look like the same character anymore.
Yeah,
Like this has completely stripped away his like Mr. Cool, like cold assassin demeanor, and now he just looks like a sick old man.
It's true, but he's got a gun, and we know that, and we suspect this is going to end up violently going some way or another.
The thing now is this doubles the intensity because there's. Killing off Serrano and Kasim, that suddenly, there's no rules now.
Yeah.
Maybe. You have no idea who's going to die.
Yeah, because if anything, they could execute the truck guys, and our little new team could easily come in and have the cursed payload that they take. It's messing with us, and we don't know what's going on.
Because even Sorcerer is destroyed, so now the only truck left is Lazaro, so they could kill Roy Scheider and Nilo and take the truck themselves, and we'll follow them the rest of the way. Yeah.
Luckily, though, Nilo was quick enough on the draw to kill everyone. And he gets shot and wounded fatally, so. But he gets off most of his shots on the baddies, or the new baddies. And, Arfith is quick with his spade and bludgeons the guy with him.
That was quite brutal.
But again, he didn't shoot it, so PG. it just showed him hitting something off screen, you know.
No, you see him get hit, and then
well, like a killing blow was not.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's only an aftershot of blood squirting out of his neck, so
you know, kids can watch it if their parents say it's okay. I mean, you know, so this is kind of the last but one thing that's the biggest challenge to deal with, I guess. But it leaves our main character alone, I guess.
This is my other my other favorite scene. I think this one is actually my favorite because it's. Roy Scheider driving.
It's weird and surreal, and you like that stuff.
And I like that in a film like this.
Sure.
Because at this point, the film has become so intense that then taking it in a like nightmare kind of direction just makes it even more disorientating. Because
this is where it becomes a bit more like Apocalypse Now, where you've gone further and further down the road / river, and this is where the madness is going
to
kick in.
Yeah, and he starts that, because he's trying to keep Nilo alive by talking to him. And then Nilo dies, and he goes into this like fugue state where he's having flashbacks.
So far as I could tell, he hasn't slept, eaten, or drunk anything since they started.
It certainly looks.
And even then, it was probably a puddle that he drank.
Yeah. So he is tripping at this point.
Going mad as well, probably. Yeah.
I like, you know, that he's having flashbacks, that he's talking to himself. I like that the shot of Nilo in the back, even before he actually dies, he's got this like ghostly white face.
I think the really clever part, I mean, I like the fact that it's flashbacks to even before, like the situation that got him into this, the crime he committed, the friends that died on the robbery. He flashbacks across the whole journey, all the weird parts, and he thinks about this current situation a bit. And we're in a weird landscape that's presumably natural. And it is, like you've got the dangling legs of the Mexican guy who was dying or dead. Just hanging out the car. What was I going to say? It was about... Oh, and the thing that I thought was really great is we established the assassin laughing at the predicament when they've just got a tree in the way. He finds it hilariously sad that the tree is... Now that they crossed the horrible bridge and survived, they have this, and it's just... He's laughing hysterically, and then that comes back in this moment amongst the surreal flashbacks.
Yeah.
This funny, evil laughter of the now-dead guy, you know?
No, that's what I was going to say as well. I like that he kind of dies laughing. There's a really cool shot with... Because all this weird stuff starts happening in amongst the flashbacks. Like, there's shots of just Roy Scheider's face, and there's, like, freeze frames of his face and lightning. And then there's a shot of Nilo, and he looks... Like, before he looked... He was lit in, like, this ghostly blue light. But in this one brief shot, he's actually made up to look like a corpse. Like, his face is white, and he's got really dark rings around his eyes.
Yeah.
And I promised I would pull this back to The Exorcist. It looks like the shots... The brief shots of the demon's face in The Exorcist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, that death mask kind of face. And, And then, there's the laugh, and then the truck breaks down.
Oh, it just runs out of, like, gas or oil or something.
I think it actually breaks, because he tries to pull the, I don't know what it's called, it's one of those...
Like a little plunger thing.
Yeah, that old-fashioned trucks have to, like, fire up the engine. He pulls it and just pulls it out. But, yeah, the truck stops, and all the crazy, surreal sounds fade away as he gets out and stumbles around. But the laugh keeps going.
Yeah.
Just that was just, I loved that. I loved that whole sequence.
And it becomes more symbolic of hell and purgatory again, doesn't it? And fate mocking.
And it's so hopeful as well. Yeah, yeah, it is. That's what it is at that point. It's that demonic face from the beginning of the film laughing at Roy Scheider and his situation.
Yeah, we just get a little establishing shot of a rock with a funny, evil-looking face on, because... Weird. And that comes back again in the flashbacks, probably, I think, as well. Maybe not. I mean, what I liked about the landscape, I mean, it's nighttime, so the blue lighting is partly natural, and the setting is unworldly, despite it being a real location, and just the time of day and the situation. So it's a lot of reality there, making a surreal thing happen. Because, you know, it can all be parts of explicable things, his memory, his mental state, you know?
That location was an absolute gift as well.
I mean, the like little turrety rock formations that have sort of unusual shapes. It's very hard to describe.
I thought it was one of those rock cities.
No, it's just formations. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, it's odd.
You get stuff like that in climates like that, like the desert in Arizona has bizarre like rock towers and things, and you look at them and you think, I don't even understand how that's standing up.
Yeah,
like what's balancing this? What's going on? But it looked alien. It didn't look real, and it was such a kind of gritty, grounded film, but with this undercurrent of strangeness that when it really hit you in the face with at the end. I felt really just, I felt like I was having a nightmare. You know when you have a really strange off dream and then you wake up and you're conscious, but it's still echoing around inside your head. So you still just wake up feeling like, ugh. That's how I felt watching that sequence.
And yeah, you have to go and you have to get up and go do something nice to make it go away.
I was going to say, a lot of the time I'll watch a film with headphones on just because I like being like immersed in it. But I didn't when I watched this. And at that point, I was kind of glad I wasn't. Because I was like, oh, I'm like, if I'd watched that with headphones, I'd have to pause it and go and take a break and come back.
Well, it's kind of there to reflect the journey we've been on as viewers. You know, we've been on their struggle with them a bit, but it's a good way to show and illustrate the mental state of our character and explain why he is driven to succeed at his goal. Like, even though the truck is broken, he's at a point where he just doesn't care, and he's going to take a crate of explosives that he would never have carried normally anywhere if he could help it, and he's going to stagger with it the two, like, he's chalked on the dashboard, like, the distance, and then he checks with the milometer, and it's like, we're about 2.5 miles away, and he's like, well, F it, I'm going to take it all the way, you know? Like,
he had no choice. Though he gotten so far that he couldn't turn back.
Yeah, and you can't give up 2 miles away after all that.
But then, you know, he could sit there and accept he's not getting out of the job. Like, he could easily be rescued or walk back, and, you know, it is closer there. And I guess he's also accepted, well, worst case scenario, I trip and I explode and die. And then it won't be a slow death if I stay here. I'll either die instantly, or I'll succeed. And I guess that's what drives him on.
That would be a thing. He's, because of all the hallucinating and being ill, he probably did want to die at that point as well. It's like,
you just grab the box and go, let's just see how it goes.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing to lose at this point. If I make it, I get $40,000, and I can spend the rest of my life severely traumatized by what I've been through, or I can fall over and blow up in the middle of the jungle.
It's an odd promise to work for as well. This idea of money and escape. Like, he already tried to escape one problem, and he ended up somewhere worse. Why does this ticket get, like, you get a passport and some money, you could end up, you know, in South Wales, and then you'd be in a worse predicament than anything you've been through.
Then there's that fantastic shot of the tower of fire that lights the whole shot as well. Mm. It's as if that, and it might have been, that fire is the light source for that scene.
Mm.
So it's bathed in this kind of hellish, like, fiery glow as he stumbles up to it.
Yeah.
And yeah,
it's almost like he's sacrificing something to Satan in a way as well, with he stumbles there.
And I like that he stumbles up with the box and they quickly kind of grab it off him.
Yeah.
And they just let him keep going and run off with the box until he just falls on his face because he can't go anymore.
I want to give props to the various fallings over in this movie. There was a lot of, when they were running away from the tree in particular, where they'd run a bit and fall over. And a couple of people did that. And his fall over in this, it is very, the klutziness of the acting, I really like.
He looked like all his bones had just disconnected from each other. It was like one of those, like, he properly just crumples onto the ground. Mm. It's like one of those things, and I never know what they're called. Do you remember the little plastic toys, and it'll be like a dog standing up with these weird legs? Yeah, you press the button and it just, like, flops down.
Yeah.
Why is that a toy?
I don't know.
watching various farmyard animals fall down limblessly is hilarious for children.
Why do you think all those fainting goats videos are so popular on YouTube?
That's true.
Because it's hilarious.
The terrorist was quite funny. When he was running from the log, I think you mentioned the from that scene, Abby, there are a lot of people running away. And he's kind of injured a bit, so he's running from the explosion. He's running from the potential explosion coming. And it is just a great way he kind of limps and falls through a puddle, and, like, it just looks really good.
And you like, everything's become so intense at that point that when he's limping away and falls over, you're just going, oh, God, come on!
Do it!
Pick it up!
Yeah. But you know, let's move to the end of the film, which is poetic in its own way as well.
So also we kind of bleak.
Yeah, horrendously bleak. We jump cut back to the shanty town and the bar and, you know, getting the signed check and to the passport.
I love that they promise him cash and he goes through all that and then they write him a check. And he goes, like, I can't cash a check. Like, what are you doing?
Just a girl in a bikini comes out with a big novelty check and Bruce Forsyth's there to interview him and pat him on the back. Well done, you've completed the challenge.
Didn't you do well?
Oh, yeah. Nice to see you struggle to your death. No, but we basically have a look on his face that just says, "I'm still not sure I'm happy about this. Yeah, I still feel like I'm trapped in hell."
Yeah,
despite getting the keys.
That's what his facial expression is like. I like that really long, just slow close up of him just looking knackered.
And it's like a relief because he survived and he succeeded, but depressed because
it's just like, what now? Yet.
Yeah, and I think there's a. And what I quite liked was he decides to get what before he's got a plane coming and stuff, and before he goes on it, he decides, you know what, I'm just going to ask the slightly worn out looking woman who's mopping to dance with me, like a proper peasanty looking lady who's worn out as the town is, and he's I'm just going to dance with you to this music, and because I want to live a little bit because I've just struggled.
That was such a nice scene because she. You know, it looks, she's never really given any history, but she's there for the whole film. And she looks like she's been in that place forever. Like, she looks like it.
Yeah, she's snaggletoothed like the town is in spirit.
Beaten up and tired looking, and she's like, he sees her scrubbing the floor. And after everything he's been through and the life she's had, he just dances with her, just for them both, just to feel something nice for a change.
Yeah.
And then the mobsters turn up and come in and shoot him.
No.
Well,
according to Wikipedia, I didn't notice this at the time. His friend Vinny, who's the one who got him over there, shows up with some other people.
With a terrible shirted gangster of some kind.
So it's ambiguous, but we've all seen crime movies.
And disaster movies. Well, what I took it to mean, Abby, is because it was his friend, the person who sent him there is the only person who could, you know, inform on him. And basically, he could be there to betray his friend. Maybe they caught up with him. He could have led them there because he's the only guy who could have known where he was going. Although he said he didn't know. But it could be a betrayal. It could be a friend. But there's a general sense of, and then the people from his old life came and are going to kill him now in this bar. Or at least there's going to be some kind of Sopranos-style shootout where we don't really know what happened, but I can probably assume it ended badly.
I do like that it doesn't give you a resolution. Like, it's probably bad.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that it's so much of a downer that they probably just go in there and shoot him in the head. That the film doesn't even show it. It just stays outside.
But
and then,
knowing his luck, he doesn't. He gets shot, but not die, and has to go through some more rigmarole and challenges to. Like, he gets shot because he's got the letter from the French guy that was supposed to be posted to the guy's wife, and is going to be. So he gets shot through the letter, which destroys the letter, so the French guy never says anything again to his wife. And he doesn't die, but then he has to survive another ordeal to get out of whatever they take him to some new kind of purgatory hell type place.
He gets shot in the head and they assume he's dead, and then he gets taken away to some cheap South American hospital, and they discover, oh wait, he's still alive, and he comes round, but he's paralysed. The end. Yeah.
And some terrible music comes on the radio.
Yeah,
and he's just stuck there listening to insert your worst type of music. Everyone has their own.
Just
Razorlight. Razorlight is playing.
Well, hang on now. I was going to say it's something from the Saturday Night Live soundtrack because it's 1977.
All right.
And there's only four types of music in 19. Oh, it's ABBA. It's bloody ABBA.
Dancing Queen. And they could just cut to that, the mopping lady who's dead and is no longer dancing.
No, well, it would be nice and... Oh, the winner takes it all. That's what
winner
would come
on. Winner takes
oh.
it all. Yeah. Abby, I'm with you. I think something nice happens. He is either rescued and they're there to meet him, or they try and kill him, but he's quick on the draw and hits them with a chair, or he just escapes and is gets away and lives his life happily, not no longer robbing churches, but lives happily forever in somewhere nice for a change. So he gets away. That's the thing. It gives you an ending that says, well, realists will have him die, and optimists will go, maybe he lives.
He runs away with the ugly woman from the bar, and they go and live on a mountain, and there's a cricket on a rock chirping, and he kills it with a knife. His hair's blonde now.
I think you're getting confused, Jamie. We've gone too far down the podcast road, and you've having flashbacks to podcasts.
They're all kind of I'm driving, and there's lightning, and the guy's laughing, and I'm having flashbacks to The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Oh, and then a really
rock and roll.
rock and roll. Oh, are those two plumbers? What are they doing here? Who's that ugly man who's supposed to look like a dinosaur, but? Clearly,
I'm driving in the truck, and there's all these lightning surreal noises, and all I hear is Mario, Mario. In the
is this a toaster with a face? Yeah, we've gone mad. We should probably do a rating system and finish the podcast, guys, because I feel like it's been a slog of a podcast as well to be in keeping with the film. But yeah, you know, it could end like Casablanca. It could end like. Something where everyone dies. Reservoir Dogs, which is kind of everyone dies but one, you know. Or we can have a bleak ending of everyone.
It does do the same thing, Reservoir Dogs. It has Mr. Pink run outside. You don't know if he's arrested or if he's shot.
Spoilers.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. We didn't say we were going to spoil Reservoir Dogs, but we are. It's good. It doesn't. You can spoil all of it you like. It's a brilliant film. Yeah. Watch it a million times.
Just as a thing for the title of the podcast, if you're one of those people whose a film or anything can be ruined by spoilers, you are shit. Because who cares about spoilers? As long as the film's good, I don't care if I know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Most films anyway. It's obvious. Toy Story. Andy burns all of his toys and stares bleakly at the out into the cinema of children and goes, "This is what I think of your whimsy." It's not going to happen, is it?
Time to grow up, kids.
Grow up. Bambi's dead and so is her mum. Anyway, we are going a bit mad. Ratings and finishing the podcast, guys.
Well... let me have a little think now. I was going to go with, like, a sorcerer, but thinking about it, actually not that many.
No.
That's not even relevant. If we did, it would be like a film that wasn't about a sorcerer. We couldn't really sum it up with an analogy about a sorcerer. What about... It's the rusty truck from Cars. It's horrible and annoying, but it's a great... No, there's nothing. It's not like the truck from Cars. Cars is not good enough to be associated with a film that I quite liked, quite frankly. It was a good disaster movie, and a good... It was a horrible, hard journey, but a good drama, and a compellingly told piece of cinema. So it's something just... very good, but something very rusty and worn out.
Yeah, it's just a rough, gritty... It's a very manly film, I will say. I mean, from the way you've talked about it, I assume you liked it, Abby. But it is a very like it's like the thing. It's lots of like craggy faced, dirty men getting dirtier and bleeding and hitting shit. And
well, you're making explosions. It sound like you know quite appealing to women who like rough, dirty men.
It is. It's very manly men, but it's very manly men. Breaking down, dying, and going insane. So there's no heroes or anything. It's just it's bleak and it's dark, but it's the definition of grit. And it's a good.
It's like some kind of fantasy old people's home for action hero.
Yes. Or it's kind of like it's like what I imagine. You know when. Like, men are like, do you know what we need to do? We need to go camping. We need to go out into the woods and get back in touch with nature and be, like, men and trackers and use knives and start fires with sticks. Mm. And then what they go through in this film is kind of like what it would actually feel like to do that.
Yeah.
And you would come home after the 2 days you've spent in the wild looking and feeling like Roy Scheider does at the end of this film.
Yeah.
It is. It's basically my experience of camping every time
I've gone. I have mine in slightly more specific. It was how dirty I felt at the end of Reading Festival.
Yeah, there you go.
A good experience. Lots of fun times and good music, but once you've been bombarded by fans of Rage Against the Machine, and yeah, you've sat in the same spot for all day, getting sunburn on the back of your neck and worn down by lack of hydration, and yeah, you know, it's fun but tiring. And we were broken, Abby, when we went to Reading Festival by the end of the day. It was like we were walking home, and we just almost couldn't. It hurt so much.
Yeah, it's like 2 or 3 days with no sleep. And no real sustenance.
Bit of Biffy Clyro to keep you going.
Yeah. No, I didn't know what to think. And when it started, I had a bit of trouble with it. Because I was like, But once I got into it, I really enjoyed it. And now, I think watching it, like repeated viewings, I think it would get better.
Yeah, I think so. It's one I'm going to be adding to my collection, I think. It's
yeah, kind of... and I'll definitely... I think it's worth, like, for me...
In your little Exorcist and related films section of your DVDs.
It's essential.
In your little shrine.
But, no, and it will be, like, a Blu-ray purchase, just because it's... I didn't talk about it much, actually. It's a fantastic-looking film.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the colour of it and the... How sweaty and like
it's very practical, very real, and you get a good sense of this part of South America.
You feel like the heat in the jungle, even in the rain. And also, we talked about the bridge scene, but the actual practical implications of setting up and filming that bridge sequence
makes
me want to cry because that just looked like a nightmare.
It did.
And I can see why William Friedkin looks back on it, and I can see why it's his favourite film of his, just because it looked horrible to make.
And it was an achievement to get it to look that way.
Yeah.
As well. So it felt horrible to make, looked horrible on purpose, and yet is exactly what it should have been, yeah.
And I think Deliverance is a good comparison, actually. I was trying to think of films it reminded me of when I was watching it, and Deliverance is definitely one of them. Deliverance and Apocalypse Now...
Yeah.
Well,
I tell you what, to cut you off there, Jamie, because otherwise, you know, we have to somehow end this journey. But actually, what I would say as a rating is it's a rusty slide. It's in a horrible, dirty playground with probably despicable things all over the floor, and it's filthy and worn out and rusty. But actually, if you climb up the horrible slide that's breaking with wooden bits coming off of it, you get to the top and you go on this journey, and it's fun, but unadvisable and horrible. And
yeah.
It's horrible, but it was thrilling and exciting. And so it's like a horrible, rusty slide.
You slide down, getting rust all over your trousers.
Yeah, and you fall into a puddle that's on fire.
And potentially risking tetanus as you slide down. But you still enjoy the physics of the event.
Yeah, it's still a slide.
Yeah.
The only other point I would kind of want to mention is I think one of the themes, you know, if it's a theme about fate and characters and stuff, like one of the key things that's subtle and early on is the wife of the French fraudster, when she gives him, she's like writing a screenplay or something or a book, and she gives him this watch and stuff, and they're discussing the script she's writing or whatever it is, and he kind of dismisses. Go on.
It's some kind of non-fiction book about somebody.
Right. And so he flippantly mentions the character being, oh, just a soldier. And I think she says something like, well, no one's just anything.
Yeah.
Like, no one is one thing just easily defined. I think that the movie's trying to make a point about these four guys, who you can define them as an assassin, a fraudster, a terrorist, and a thief. But there's so many sides to their story. Like, you know, you can't, they're not... They're not just these things. They are.
They're all,
you know.
that's one of the good things about it, is there's not that much dialogue and there's not that much actual like character exploration.
Yeah.
But they kind of speak for themselves. You get stuff from them just from their actions.
Mm. And I think, you know, the people from New Jersey who want to come and kill this guy because he stole from them, you know, they don't care or know about all the journey he's been through. So every character has been through this experience. Some have died, but everyone, there's more than just one thing that defines them. And I think that's kind of what it's saying, is fate doesn't care about you, but it doesn't mean that you're just one thing fated to one end. There's so much more to you as a person. Maybe something like that is being said. Just an idea.
I think that's pretty good. Because to them, he's still just the guy who ripped them off.
Yeah, but yet, you know,
they don't know what he's been through.
Yeah, and everyone who comes to this film might have a different take on the characters and the journey and things. So there, no one is just defined one way. You can interpret the film many ways. You can interpret the characters, and they're bad guys, but they're good guys, and they're, you know, they're anti-heroes, and yet they're our filmic heroes, because we're going on the journey. You know, there's lots of layers to the film as well. And I think that bears up to repeat watching to get more out of it, I think. Also, what happened to the guy who got arrested in Jerusalem? What's his story? Did he just go to jail? Is his fate better than theirs? Is he the kingpin of the jail now? Yeah, it's a thought.
If his fate was anything like the rest of them, he had a brain aneurysm on the way to be prosecuted and just dropped dead completely unexpectedly.
Yeah, maybe so. Well, anyway, that's us at the end of the podcast, I think. Time to drop down dead at the fire. Or just say goodbye to the listener, whatever.
Bye!
Bye.
Bye-bye.